Afternoon. We're ready for our third case today, 10-AP-594, State versus Carl Cornelius Gilbert, 10-AP-1155, State versus Price T. Hunt. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Hunt for 20 minutes will be Eric J. Van, is it Schindel? Pardon me?
Scandal.
Okay, thank you. And 20 minutes for Hannah B. Scheiber, Assistant State Public Defender for Mr. Gilbert, and the State Assistant Attorney General Warren Weinstein has 45 minutes, and 5 minutes has been allotted to Ms. Scheiber for rebuttal, correct? Okay. Counsel?
May it please the Court, on behalf of Mr. Hunt, the first issue before the Court today is whether the actions of the State violate the plain language of Chapter 980, requiring that this Court vacate the commitment order and dismiss the underlying petitions against Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert. Counsel for Mr. Gilbert is going to argue the constitutionality issues after myself, and I will be arguing the statutory issues. We didn't want the Court to have to hear the same arguments twice from on the same issue since we are aligned. The review is undisputed as de novo. Also, the facts, the few facts that are relevant to the issues here today, are also undisputed. Mr. Gilbert's petition was filed on December 4th of 2006. He was evaluated on October 10th of 2007. And then after that, his parole was revoked, and he was sentenced until August 28th of 2010. His proceedings for Chapter 980 continued on while he was in DOC custody, and he was found to be a sexually violent person on February 7th of 2008, long after he was already in DOC custody and long before he was going to be released from DOC custody. Mr. Gilbert brought a post-commitment hearing motion, and that hearing took place on February 18th of 2010. For Mr. Hunt, he had a petition filed against him on August 23rd of 2007. The evaluation that was used in committing him first took place on November 14th of 2008. He was subsequently revoked for his extended supervision. He was sent back to prison then until March 30th of 2010. While he was in DOC custody, and before March 30th of 2010, he was found to be a sexually violent person on August 4th of 2009. The statutes are unambiguous here, and it's not the function of the court to rewrite the statutes. Clearly, from the timing that's been shown here and the plain language of Chapter 980, both Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert's commitments were issued at the wrong time, and timing is everything in a Chapter 980 commitment. First, the argument between the State and Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Hunt is whether or not Chapter 980, Section 980.06 and 980.065 requires that a commitment order shows that someone should immediately be put into DHS custody. Plainly, 980.06 says the court shall order the person to be committed to the custody of the department, and that department is the Department of Health Services, for control, care, and treatment until such time as the person is no longer a sexually violent person. Following along from that, 980.065, the Department of Health Services shall place a person that has been committed to either Sandridge, Wisconsin Resource Center, or a secure mental health unit or facility provided by the Department of Corrections under Subdivision 2 in 980.065. DHS has been required, if the court orders the commitment order, to place that individual into a DHS-operated facility. That did not take place for Mr. Hunt nor Mr. Gilbert, obviously a violation of Chapter 980, and obviously showing that their commitments could not have been fulfilled. Now, a big reason why the timing is important in Chapter 980 is because, as Counsel for Gilbert will argue in a little while, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask a question.
I'm sorry.
Didn't want to jump over your learned comments. You quote from 980.06, which requires that the court order a person committed to the custody of the department. Why can't there be concurrent custody?
Your Honor, that's because of several different reasons. First, control, care, and treatment. If DHS doesn't have the physical custody of a individual who's been determined to be sexually violent, they cannot provide control. They don't physically have control of that person. They can't provide them with care or treatment. That obviously would be a violation then of 980.06. If an order has been issued that they have to go to DHS to be able to get that treatment or to be able to have that control, DHS can't provide that if they're in DOC custody at the time.
Well, let's look at these words. The court shall order the person to be committed to the custody of the department for control, care, and treatment. Why does for control, care, and treatment necessarily mean the department the department itself providing it, as opposed to the department arranging for it to be provided?
Your Honor, we believe that that's because, again, it's saying that DHS shall do that, and then if you read it along with 980.065, that requires the Department of Health Services to place the individual into three different possible locations. One is Sandridge, which is an institution that needs to be operated and established by the Department of Health Services. Two is the Wisconsin Resource Center, which, again, is operated and established by the Department of Health Services. And three is a mental health facility that could be at a DOC facility but must be operated by the Department of Health Services. Again, putting all of those two statutes together, that shows a clear requirement that the Department of Health Services has to be the entity providing that treatment, the entity in control of the individual.
Mr. Van Scandal, what's wrong at this point with a transfer to one of those three locations for each of the two individuals involved here, rather than a dismissal of the 980 petition, which appears to me to be a rather extreme remedy that you're asking for? What's wrong with a transfer?
Brenner, are you asking at the time that the petition is pending or today?
Today.
Well, I guess part of the problem that if that happens today is they're already there. Both Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert are both at Sandridge.
No, but we're going to face this in the future, so we're not just talking about these two individuals.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about other people that this could happen to and is likely to have happened to in the future. Isn't a transfer easy enough to remedy the situation rather than a dismissal?
Your Honor, I would argue no. And the reason for that is the current mental circumstances are required to determine whether or not a person is going to be a sexually violent person. And if the only remedy is to transfer that individual to Sandridge or Wisconsin Resource Center, are you saying that they would then serve their DOC incarceration there at the same time? If they're receiving treatment and they're receiving essentially what they would get out of the cases in White and Suzaleski, then the answer was that would be okay. But that's not what happened here. Instead, both Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert were sent to DOC, where they did not receive care, control, and treatment. Thus, nothing under 980 that would establish that their commitment was both constitutional and valid.
Okay, well, why can't a person who has committed a crime or had probation revoked and is also, because of the prior conviction, subject to 980. So why can't you send them to DOC, have them serve the sentence, and then when that sentence is about up, file your 980. The state files its 980 under Treadway kind of concept that, sure, he's no longer serving a sentence under that's a sexual offense, but Treadway says, "Hell, heck, you don't have to wait. You don't have to do that." When
who wrote Treadway?
I didn't look. I hope I didn't. Did I?
No.
No, I thought it was a court of appeals decision.
It was court of appeals, Your Honor.
See, I know the case. So the thing that was goofed up here, according to you, was that the state brought the 980 too early, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, you can say, hey, too early, you're out, this guy gets released. Or you can say, it was filed too early, but we are going to consider that it's like a still pending. In fact, the federal court just did that in Milwaukee on some case, and it was filed too early, and the event happened that should have been the filing, and then the federal court said, okay, they filed too early, let them amend the darn thing, and we'll take it from here instead of dismissing, having a file again. You know, that's very formal instead of substance. So what's the matter of saying that we're going to treat this as if the state filed it when they were finally out of prison?
So, Your Honor, you're saying that in the circumstances we're talking here with Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert, that you would vacate the order but continue the petition?
That's right. And say, hey, they get a good hearing now, and that's going to take care of the constitutional issue, which I assume is going to be argued that it's too far back. You have to do it at the time you're committing him, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have a nice hearing now, and we'll do it all over. Because otherwise, what you're asking for as a practical matter is a guy who commits an offense and is sent to prison for doing that, while there's a 980 that could have been brought, stating it generally, he gets rewarded with, if you can call it a reward, X number of days, months, or years in prison. But the reward is he is not subject to indeterminate institutionalization. And I'm not so sure that it's not. In fact, I would say it's arguable that it's better to take your 2 years in prison than to take an indeterminate institutionalization as a civil commitment under 980, and you never know whether you're going to get out, if ever. Right?
There's two things I want to say on this issue, Your Honor. First, it's that Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert have one divergent aspect in their argument, and this would be it. Mr. Hunt agrees with you and agrees that a vacation of the order, but continuation and a new trial based upon his circumstances today would be appropriate.
Right.
But I do have to agree partially with what you had to say and disagree partially. I agree that there is a possible parade of horribles that isn't existent in this case right here today. Also, I agree that it may not exactly be the best situation for anybody to get a new prison sentence in order to avoid a commitment. I can't imagine anybody really thinking that it would be excellent to go to prison for 2, 5, 20 years as opposed to...
You have to pick your crime carefully.
I'm sorry, what did you say, Your Honor?
You have to pick your crime carefully.
I think you have to, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a way for... I'm not... This my concept here doesn't depend on a person intentionally gaming the system.
Mm-hmm.
But here, unintentionally, what you're doing is rewarding a person who went to prison. That's what you're asking the court to do, rather than a person who doesn't commit a crime and then is subject to commitment.
And what you're also suggesting, Your Honor, is permitted by the statutes, in particular 980.05.1, permits the court to grant one or more continuances of the trial date for good cause upon either the motion of the court or one of the parties. Now, that could be a way to resolve this issue that for individuals coming after Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert, the court would then stay, essentially, continue the trial proceedings allowing still for an individual subject to the petition to be committed, if at all, based upon their present mental circumstances and not how they were 2, 5, 10 years before.
Can they also stay the prison sentence?
Also stay the prison sentence, Your Honor?
Yeah, I mean, the guy is charged with a new crime, right? Can they somehow stay those proceedings?
Well, with
until
a new
after
crime,
commitment?
With a new crime, that's correct, and that's what happened in both White, where Section 973 point, I believe it's 15 sub 8, permits the trial court to stay a new sentence in lieu of a commitment. And that was continued reasoning from this court in State v. Suzaleski, which had to do with an NGI commitment. And in both of those cases, neither in 980 or in the NGI statutes, is there permission to stay a commitment. And that's part of what our issue is here today, that effectively Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert's commitments under 980 were stayed, but without statutory authority to do so.
What kind of a rule do you want this court to issue in this case?
For Mr. Hunt, Your Honor, and again, I need to stress that this is slightly different from Mr. Gilbert. Mr. Hunt would prefer a vacation of the petition and also vacation of the order and a dismissal of the petition. But he would also be amenable, if it's what the court requires, that the order itself is vacated and a new trial is held on the petition, so that, again, he gets the constitutionally sound proceedings of a 980 trial based upon his present mental circumstances and not how he was back in 2007.
And what about Mr. Gilbert?
I will leave that to Mr. Gilbert, Your Honor.
Counsel, okay.
Yes.
I understand that.
Counsel, you've been granted, you were not so much, but Mr. Gilbert was, extra time here. And I thought the gist of the request was that there are significantly different factual facts with respect to the two cases. I'm not sure I'm getting the distinction.
There is a distinction in terms of there is a more developed record for Mr. Gilbert in terms of the constitutional issues involved here. We don't know whether or not, but based upon the record, but I do believe, we don't know whether or not Mr. Hunt received any sort of treatment while he was in DOC incarceration, but before he was finally transferred to DHS. That is at least our argument and Mr. Gilbert's argument that affects the constitutionality of 980. If someone is committed under 980 but does not receive any care, control, or treatment, that seriously questions the constitutionality of the entire Chapter 980 process, let alone for Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert. The request for additional time was based upon the fact that we had a lot of issues here, and while many of them are aligned, it was going to be much easier if the court would be able to have the opportunity to ask questions of both counsel in both scenarios here. And again, Mr. Hunt's situation questions the statutory interpretation of 980 under both the Court of Appeals reasoning and also the state's reasoning. And there are even better constitutional questions for Mr. Gilbert.
Would you like to address 980-076M at all?
Sure, Your Honor, if you would like me to. 6M, as the state has argued and also how the Court of Appeals reason, permits someone who has already been committed but receives either a new criminal sentence or is revoked on a previous sentence to essentially have the reexamination period in 980-07 told. And obviously that's important because reexamination is something that, again, keeps 980 constitutional in the first place and the commitment constitutional. 980-07 doesn't apply here. 980-76M, I'm sorry, doesn't apply here, and unfortunately all of 980-07 didn't seem to apply here to either Mr. Hunt or Mr. Gilbert while they were in DOC custody. Again, 980-07-6M, on its face, says important things such as a individual who is committed, and then also even more importantly, in the last sentence, the schedule for reporting established under subsection 1 shall resume upon the release of the person. Now, if Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert, as the state concedes, never were in DHS custody. It's very difficult for these timelines in 9807 that DHS has to adhere to could start, let alone resume, if they never were transferred there in the first place.
How are you so sure that 980076M doesn't apply to someone who had been incarcerated because of parole revocation before the commitment?
Because particularly 980076M says a person committed under 980-06. Talking about the past tense as if the individual has already been committed, not a person who is going to be committed. And it also, in particular, doesn't say anything about an individual who is currently in the proceedings for commitment. It's very noticeably absent of that fact. And 6M is very narrow in how it seems to be tailored. If the legislature wanted to, I'm sorry, Your Honor, my red light's on, may I finish? If the legislature wanted to specifically state that it also applied to individuals who were subject to a petition, it could have done so, but it did not.
Now, 6M doesn't refer to extended supervision. It only refers to parole, but that makes no difference to you. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor, in terms of the general argument that 6M wouldn't apply to these specific circumstances. But for Mr. Hunt in particular, he was revoked based upon extended supervision. So you are correct in saying that that's another reason that 6M could not apply to Mr. Hunt's scenario.
Well, but you said this subsection doesn't apply.
That's what I'm saying, Your Honor. You gave me another great reason as to why this doesn't apply to Mr. Hunt.
Okay.
Are there any further questions?
I think not. Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Scheiber, representing Mr. Gilbert.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Hannah Scheiber on behalf of Respondent Appellate Petitioner Carl Cornelius Gilbert, Jr. This case comes down to the state's ability to pursue two forms of custody, one being revocation to return somebody to the custody of the Department of Corrections to continue serving a criminal sentence, the other being initial civil commitment to place somebody in the custody of the Department of Health Services for the control, care, and treatment of a current existing mental condition. The state in these cases had the authority to pursue both forms of custody. The state did not, however, have the authority to pursue both forms of custody at the same time. Nevertheless, the state chose to do so, and in so doing, exceeded both the boundaries of the plain language of Chapter 980 as well as the Constitution. The rule that this court should therefore adopt is when the state revokes the parole or extended supervision of someone who is the subject of a pending 980 petition, the state must move to dismiss the petition and subsequently refile once the person approaches release from prison. And I'd like to briefly go back before I move to my core arguments to a question Chief Justice raised earlier. Why couldn't we instead perhaps ask that the state could file the petition and then in essence have the petition stayed? The one potential ramification of that I'd like to bring to the court's attention is the effect that a 980 petition would have hanging over the head of somebody who's been returned to prison. We see from Mr. Gilbert's record that DOC was not in any way providing treatment, as they viewed it as a waste of resources because Chapter 980 DHS would then ultimately be able to provide treatment. Now, that's a slightly different circumstance because in Mr. Gilbert's case, he had already been committed, so DOC knew that he would definitely then ultimately be placed in DHS custody. But I just wanted to raise that that's one potential drawback of doing, of in essence, staying the petition. The other is that the plain language of Chapter 980 does not provide the state that authority. But moving beyond the plain language, I'd really like to focus on two points. The first is that revocation and civil commitment cannot be pursued simultaneously, and the other is that due process requires that civil commitment be based on a current existing mental condition. Turning to the first point.
If a civil commitment petition is filed, mm-hmm. and then the defendant commits a crime, your position is that the defendant is empowered to force the termination? Is that right?
Well, no. What we're arguing, Your Honor, is that the state here has choices. So the state can decide where its priorities lie. An important point that I want to make in these about these two specific cases is that we're dealing with revocation. And where in other cases it could be slightly different because, let's say, the new crime that the person committed is not a 980 predicate offense, and in that situation we're dealing with slightly different ramifications. But Sizlecki and White tell us that in that circumstance, a circuit court would have the authority to stay the criminal sentence if that's what the state wished to pursue. In the narrow set of facts with revocation, the state will not be prevented from pursuing civil commitment. Because when the state revokes somebody's parole or supervision and returns them to the custody of Department of Corrections, they will again approach release from prison, and when they do, they will still be serving the one continuous sentence that encompasses the 980 predicate offense. So with these cases where we're dealing with revocation, we don't have to worry in the future that someone could potentially game the system and avoid civil commitment, because the state will have the opportunity. And that leads back into the point I was making about revocation. When we look at 980 as a whole, what we have is a system for civil commitment that is designed to trigger as a person approaches release from prison. We see this first and foremost in the statutes themselves. 980.015 tells us that DOC must notify DOJ that someone could be potentially committable beginning 90 days prior to their release from a sentence of imprisonment. And the Court of Appeals has consistently reaffirmed this idea that it is the release from prison that triggers the 980 process. In 1997, in State v. Keith, the Court of Appeals held that the state did not err when it initiated a 980 petition 90 days prior to the person's release from prison, even where Mr. Keith had been serving two consecutive sentences, one a 980 predicate offense, the other not, and he had served the 980 predicate offense first. And in the Keith case, the Court of Appeals explained that interpreting Chapter 980 to focus and begin as someone will be released from prison makes sense in light of the two central purposes for 980 that this court articulated in the Carpenter and Post cases, those being protecting the public and treatment. The state becomes concerned about both of those purposes as someone will be released from prison. That's when the state asks, does the public have to be concerned? Do we have to be concerned about public safety? And that's when the state asks, is this person in need of treatment in a confined setting? And in 2002...
Counsel, just let me interrupt you briefly. Yes. That's because the phrase in the statute is release from a continuous term of incarceration. Mm-hmm. So that completely makes sense to me, that when you have two terms of imprisonment, and you're going to serve the confinement portion, mm-hmm. that the confinement portions be served and then someone be subject potentially to the commitment near the end of the confinement portion. But is that what you had here? Or was the person going to be released? The notice was given within 90 days. They started the commitment proceeding, and then the person was either revoked or, under justice process analysis, commits another crime. I mean, those are two different things, because you can't really know whether someone's going to have to be revoked. You can't really know if someone's going to have to serve an additional portion of an extended supervision provision. And if I were defense counsel on a 980, I'd be arguing, well, not in this scenario, but if you don't do it within 90 days, if that notice isn't given, and if they don't properly file the petition timely, and then something subsequently happens later, I'd argue you don't start the clock ticking all over again. You don't give them a new window of opportunity to file a commitment when the state didn't do it right the first time. So, I mean, which is it that you want? Does the state get a new kick at the cat every time somebody goes in, so long as they once have been convicted of a sexually violent offense? Is that really what you want?
What we're asserting is that in cases that deal with revocation, I agree with Your Honor, for cases where it's an entirely new criminal conviction, where that person is not on a form of supervision, and what the state is pursuing is criminal prosecution for an entirely new sentence. But for purposes of revocation, In re Parish tells us that even with revocation, it's still the one continuous sentence of imprisonment.
But I'm just saying, be careful what you wish for. Because let's say the state blew it, and they mm-hmm. didn't file that before the person was released, okay? Mm-hmm. You're saying that the state then, if they were revoked and went back to prison or served some part of their extended supervision, state gets a new opportunity to file. And, in fact, that'd be preferable, to make sure they finish their entire term of extended supervision or parole. And if they happen to be revoked or happen to go back for some reason, that the state gets a second chance. Even if they blew it the first time around, they get a second chance to file a commitment proceeding.
Yes,
is that
Your
really
Honor.
What you want?
Yes, Your Honor, because that's what Parrish tells us Chapter 980 is designed to do. And in that situation that you pointed to, you mentioned that it would be ideal to bring it as the person is approaching release from prison, because the state would want to consider the circumstances that took place during that revocation sentence.
But the state won't necessarily know that they're going to be revoked from parole or receive a sentence of confinement as depleting a portion of their extended supervision. The state won't necessarily know that. And this 980, the whole thing's premised upon the idea of somebody's about ready to get out, we better file this before they're actually released. So how do you reconcile those two things? I mean, it's supposed to happen before they're actually released. And what I hear from you, I think, is, never mind, you don't really have to do that. If you do it, you can do it that way. But, state, if you don't do it that way and they end up being revoked for some reason, you can always do it later. Is that really what you want?
Let me see if I can explain it in a different way. Our position is not that when the state initiated the petition against Mr. Gilbert, that was an error. The error, because you're right, the state doesn't know if Mr. Gilbert is going to do something or someone in the future is going to do something that would warrant revocation. The problem comes when the state chooses to revoke that person, because at that point the state has said, what we are choosing to do is return you to prison. And the problem is that civil commitment is based on control, care, and treatment in the custody of the Department of Health Services. So that's where the tension is created. So at that point, our position is, when the state has chosen to return that person to serve years in prison, the state must then dismiss the 980 petition, and then once the person has served their revocation sentence, the state will have the authority to, again, refile the petition at the constitutionally appropriate time.
And then if it's, as Justice Prosser suggested, let's just say it's a, you know, assault charge that's a felony and they go to prison for that of some sort, okay? Or OWI fifth offense, something like that, right? Totally not a sex offense. You're suggesting that in charging the person with the crime, the state then would still have to wait until they're within 90 days of release to file and then allege that they're being released for that, just at some point in their life they've been convicted of a sexually violent offense and that would be good enough? Or does the state then have to say, you know what, we'd rather have a commitment and so we're not going to charge you with the new crime, so it's kind of a pass, you know, commit a new crime if you want because there's no penalty for it. I'm not getting it. Okay. You got to connect the dots for me.
Okay. Well, again, I want to stress that we're dealing here with revocation, but in the example that you've provided where someone is about to be released from their 980 predicate offense continuous sentence, the state initiates a petition. They're released, and at that point, are we assuming that they're not on any form of supervision?
It, let's just say they're on parole and they commit another crime. Okay. That's not completely uncommon, but it's not a sexually violent offense.
Okay.
What happens? The state has to choose a commitment or charging them with a new crime?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the Suzlecki cases and the White cases tell us that under 973-15-8A, a circuit court has the power to stay a new sentence of imprisonment. So in that situation, a circuit court would have the power to stay the criminal sentence until the completion of the civil commitment. And I think that's what Suzlecki and White tells us. And
so they go from the treatment facility to prison, presumably.
I think that
would be the suggestion that you have in that scenario.
I think that's what Suzlecki and White tells us, and I think the important thing to note is that the criminal statutes tell us that the circuit court has the authority to stay a sentence of imprisonment. Nowhere in Chapter 980 does the legislature provide the state the power to stay the execution of an initial civil commitment. And there's a reason, a more fundamental reason, why the legislature did not provide the state that authority. And that leads me to my second point, the constitutional ramifications of today's case. In 1992, in Fauscia v. Louisiana, the United States Supreme Court held that due process requires that civil commitment be based on a current existing mental condition. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court also held that due process also requires that the nature and duration of the commitment bear some reasonable relation to the purpose for that commitment. The problem is, should this court expand the boundaries of Chapter 980 and authorize the state to move forward with the 980 petition despite returning the subject to prison, is that the end result will be civil commitment proceedings that do not reflect the person's mental conditions and treatment needs at the time they're actually civilly committed.
Well, if I understood the argument of your co-counsel, a client Hunt is willing to say, okay, he agrees with you about the constitutional issue, but that the order that he be committed should be vacated because it's void, because it wasn't done at the proper time, but that the state's petition, he doesn't necessarily say it the way I will, but state's petition is out there, and it is dormant until 90 days before the Hunt gets out from his current prison sentence. Mm-hmm. And then it springs into life, and he gets a commitment hearing as relating to his mental condition as of now. Mm-hmm. But I understand your client is not willing to say, hey, okay, it was too early, but we're going to fix it up. Your client says it's too early then and it's too late now. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And how do you justify that?
We justify that because even if this court were to say today that it would order that Mr. Gilbert receive a new trial, that wouldn't remedy the fact that Mr. Gilbert sat for over 2.5 years civilly committed in prison, unable to receive treatment. And that wouldn't remedy the fact that he's spent the time he's actually been civilly committed, he's been committed in a way that violated due process because his commitment proceedings had nothing to do with his current mental circumstances. The mental evaluations that provided the state the ability to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was subject for commitment occurred 2 years and 10 months before he was actually civilly committed. And the trial and commitment order occurred 2 years and 7 months before. And what the state is, in essence, asking of this court is to adopt a notion of anticipatory commitment. And by that I mean the state is asking this court to assume that just because somebody could potentially be committable before their revocation sentence, they automatically will be after. But Fauscia tells us that that is an unconstitutional assumption to make. Circumstances change, mental conditions change, and treatment needs change. And this is further exacerbated in Mr. Gilbert's case by the fact that treatment, the central factor that this court has pointed to as what separates 980 civil commitment from criminal punishment, was wholly unavailable to Mr. Gilbert for over 2.5 years. The record here is clear. He was in Waupun Correctional. Waupun Correctional did not provide him any treatment. They viewed it as a waste of resources, and DHS was not in any way involved in treating him.
Well, he was in Waupun under a criminal court proceeding, right?
Yes.
He also, there was an order for his commitment under 980. But he can't be in two places at once, right?
Exactly.
So the state chose prison. Now, had they not brought the 980, right, it was okay to put him in prison, right?
Yes.
And had they not brought the 980 and put him in prison, would it be okay within, what is it, 90 days after his release from prison to have brought a Chapter 980?
After his revocation sentence?
Yeah.
Yes, and that is exactly what we're asking.
That's right. But you're saying you're not asking for that because the 90 days has passed, hasn't it?
Yes.
And the state didn't do it.
Yes.
Right? Therefore, you're saying state didn't do it 90 days as required by the statute. He is home free. That's what you're asking.
The state in this case knew its boundaries and here chose to exceed those boundaries.
Okay. Well, that's your version of the law. It won't be the state's. And the question is, what should the court's version of the law be? And you're asking us to say that a person who should be committed, might be committed, under 980 should be let free, maybe danger, and the whole point about commitment to 980 is danger to the public, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should be let free, even if he's dangerous to the public, because the state acted too early. And that's what you're asking the court to say.
We're asking the court to say that in this specific case, the state chose to exceed the boundaries before him, and as a result, Mr. Gilbert suffered due process and other constitutional violations. But we're also asking the court for clarification that in future cases, that in circumstances dealing with revocation, the state has the authority to pursue both civil commitment and criminal punishment. The state just has to operate within the boundaries of both criminal law and Chapter 980.
And how do they do that?
I see my time has expired. May I answer your question?
I insist.
They do that by initiating a 980 petition 90 days prior to someone's release from prison. Then if the person does not commit any sort of acts that warrant revocation, they move forward with the 980 and they place somebody in DHS custody. However, if the state makes the decision to revoke that person's parole or extended supervision, the state moves to dismiss the 980 petition and then subsequently refiles it as the person is within 90 days of their release from their revocation sentence.
Suppose someone is the subject of a 980 petition. They are committed.
Okay.
They are at Sandridge.
Okay.
And then they commit a very serious crime.
Mm-hmm.
What happens then?
I think in that situation, Justice Prosser, we're guided by 980.076M, which tells us that in that circumstance, the state has the authority to return somebody to the custody of the Department of Corrections to serve their criminal sentence, and then once that sentence has been completed, return them back to DHS custody. But that's not what happened here, and there are important distinctions.
Okay, but what about all these constitutional arguments that you're making? How does that square with the statute you cited?
I think there are some potential constitutional implications of 980.076M, but that's not this case. A central difference is that for the purposes of our constitutional arguments, a central difference is that for the person who has already been committed, is already in Sand Ridge, and then subsequently commits new crimes and is returned to DOC custody, that person's initial civil commitment was based on their current mental conditions. That is not the same for Mr. Gilbert. And that person, unlike Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Hunt, who is already committed and in DHS custody and then is subsequently returned to DOC custody, that person had the ability to receive the treatment that 980 demands, but through their own actions gave up that ability. Mr. Gilbert never even had the opportunity to receive that treatment.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. In this case, it seems to me that Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Hunt equate commitment with physical confinement. And I think, just like a criminal conviction, which is really a judgment, a commitment is really a judgment. And the commitment section of 06 requires the court to order commitment, and it did so in this case, and it did so on a finding of evidence and an instruction to jury, at least in one of the cases, an instruction to a jury that the jury must find the person had a mental disorder at the time the jury made its decision and at the time that the order was entered. I think what dispels the argument that physical confinement equals the commitment is 980.076M and, if you will, the NGI analogy. Because in that case, in Shulshevsky, and in the case where the legislature has said that if someone is convicted of a crime after the commitment order is entered, then the sentence takes effect and the person goes to DOC's physical confinement. I think that it's also incorrect to say that Mr. Gilbert or Mr. Hunt was committed unconstitutionally because there's no finding of current mental disorder for that very reason. And I also dispute, but I'll get to it a little later, that current mental condition is even a requirement for constitutionality of a commitment. An NGI is not based on current mental condition. It's based on the mental condition at the time of the crime, not at the time of the commitment. So if they are correct, seems to me that the NGI system, which is, of course, in every state and in the federal government, would be in serious trouble.
Counsel, go ahead. Go ahead, please. Are you saying that the finding of current dangerousness is supposed to be related to the date of the predicate event? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that I don't think there's a constitutional requirement that a mental disorder or mental illness be current. Fuchsia says no such thing. Fuchsia is a burden of proof case. Fuchsia dealt with the fact that Louisiana required the person committed to prove they were no longer subject to commitment. It does say that when either a mental disorder or illness or dangerousness no longer exists, the state can no longer continue the commitment. But that principle actually comes from O'Donnell, not from Fuchsia.
Well, and doesn't that, Counselor, but doesn't that require the finding be at the time of the commitment hearing? Because if the state has not proven that there is current dangerousness at that time, I don't see how they can meet the test you just
set out. That's what the statute requires, and that's what the instructions require. What I'm saying is that there's no constitutional provision that the mental illness be a current mental illness. Now that may well be what the Constitution requires, but there's no Supreme Court case saying that at this point. What the Supreme Court has said at this point is, if you have established a mental illness and if you have established dangerousness, once either of those abates, the commitment must terminate. Well, of course, we can't do it instantaneous, which is why we have the periodic examination. But I think it's incorrect to say that a commitment that is based on a finding of a mental disorder that's not current is unconstitutional, because NGI is not based on a mental disorder that is current.
In Carpenter, focusing on the statute, I said the court said the focus of the statute is on the offender's current medical condition and the present danger to the public.
There's no question the statute focuses on that. That's right. But I don't think it's a constitutional, well, it may or may not be a constitutional requirement.
Okay, so are you...
But I think the real problem here is a question of execution of the judgments. And that was exactly the problem in Krzyzewski, too, because you have two orders for physical confinement operating at the same time. And as the chief pointed out, a person can't be in two places at once, so one of them has to take precedence.
They could have if they put him in a mental institution in a prison.
Right.
So it's possible, but that's a statutory exception or a statutory
and
provision.
And in Krzyzewski, in the Court of Appeal, which wasn't an issue in this court, the Court of Appeals held that the criminal judgment took precedence. You can avoid all of this problem if you say, in a 980 case, the commitment takes precedence, and I think that's what Justice Crooks was getting to. The problem, it doesn't create a problem, I don't think, in 980. What it does is it denigrates the criminal law, because it basically gives a person a pass for committing a crime.
But that depends on how you define commitment.
Well,
you started out your presentation with two things. You started out by talking about a plain language reading in contrast to Van Scandal's presentation, and a little bit that was alluded to by his co-counsel in regard to 980.06, that they were, this is how I took what you were saying, that they were reading into that statute the word immediate or physical or both, right immediately prior to the phrase custody of the department.
Correct.
And so you followed that by saying, a commitment can be, as we know by analogous situations in the criminal law, a commitment that does not include a physical one.
Right.
So that was my observation as to what you were just saying. It depends. Sure, it can take precedence, but it could be secondary. But it all depends on how you define commitment.
Right. And then the question becomes, where does the physical body actually where is it actually placed? And it seems to me their argument is, essentially, it's required to be placed at DHS.
Immediately.
Or really any time, I suppose.
Right.
And that if it's not, then we have a problem, unless, of course, the conviction is after the commitment, which, in my view, there's no principled way of distinguishing whether or not the judgment of commitment is entered before or the judgment of conviction is entered before or after the judgment of commitment. Either they can exist together or they can't, seems to me.
An analysis which turns on the definition of a commitment.
Right. But it seems to me that if what you say is, in a 980 situation, we're going to have the physical custody of this individual placed with DHS regardless. What you've done is you've given the person a pass for the criminal law. They can now assault people in the institution with impunity because they're not going anywhere. They might be convicted of a crime, but they're going to stay there. And that's exactly the problem that Krzyzewski presented to the court. And one of the reasons that the court, that this court decided that the circuit court should have some discretion in deciding whether to stay the criminal sentence or not, was that the court ought to be able to take into account this individual and decide where they're better suited. And that would serve both the purpose of the commitment and the conviction. If you say, though, in this kind of a case, in a 980 case, the person automatically stays in DHS no matter what, that doesn't exist. And the problem, I think, and the reason I think the reason that the circuit courts never considered staying the thing, the entire proceeding until after the conviction was, or the revocation ran, was because there is no authority in 980, as the Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Hunt point out correctly, there's no authority for a stay. It would be a very long continuance, especially in Mr. Hunt's case.
What's the matter with what Mr. Hunt suggests, if I understood it correctly, that, look, he's not asking that he go free now. He's asking that he just get a new Chapter 980 hearing. The burden of proof is on the state. He's entitled to a jury trial. And find out whether right now he should be under a 980 commitment. What's the matter with that from the state's point of view, saying, okay, the order was too soon, we're going to hold the petition in abeyance until it's ripe. It's ripe as soon as he's the 90 days starts under the that will release him from incarceration. What seems to me the state ought to grab that. Your argument in your briefs were that, hey, the state can't make it's too difficult for the circuit court and the state, for the state to make repeated motions hoping that it's going to hit the right time.
Well, I think, first of all, the statute does give the state the right to file either at release or at discharge. So that's something the legislature has committed to the state, and this would, I think, kind of require the state to end up filing only at discharge under peril that the person might
When are the two choices of the state for filing?
Either release, and then there's a laundry list of what the release can be for,
okay,
or discharge.
All right.
Now, the problem, it seems to me, is that if the state files at discharge and this happens, then we're assuming that if DOC is entitled to any custody, it has to be under a criminal conviction. But now we don't have a sexually violent offense. Or I would be very surprised if we had a sexually violent offense.
I don't think Treadway covers that.
It's almost always assault of one of the, either a patient or a,
I know,
or a staff. And so I think I heard the term 90 days several times. 90 days, at least from the state's point of view, is no longer in the statute.
Mm-hmm.
It is still there for the notification by the custodian, either DOC or DHF, and there's some amount of case law that seems to indicate, and I certainly would think I would be back here arguing, if the state filed without a referral or if DOC made a referral from a non-sexual offense. So I think there's at best an open question about whether the state could file if the person is off paper from a sexually violent offense and then comes to release. And I don't think, my personal view is, that's something the legislature wouldn't have envisioned in this statute.
But here, because it's revocation, they would still be on paper.
He may or may not. It would depend on how long he was recommitted for. I mean, the ALJ can send the person back for the balance of the sentence.
Mm-hmm. But then it would be discharge for the qualifying. So either way,
the state could refile. That's
release
correct.
Or discharge, he's still subject to the filing of a petition for a sexually
right.
violent.
But as Mr. Gilbert demonstrates, it's not uncommon for Mr. Gilbert to do two assaults. So in that situation, the second assault gives him a pass for the commitment for the sexually violent offense.
Why doesn't Treadway come into play?
I'm sorry?
Why doesn't the Court of Appeals Treadway, is it Treadway or Treadway, come into effect?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Why doesn't the Court of Appeals Treadway case come then into effect?
Because it has to be either a consecutive or concurrent sentence, and if the person's been discharged, you can't make a new sentence consecutive unless you have a prior sentence or concurrent either. You have to have – it has to be concurrent or consecutive to another sentence. If the person's off paper,
mm-hmm.
they're no longer serving a sentence. And I can't remember the
but
case,
are they
but
off
I know
paper?
There's a case saying you can't make a new sentence concurrent to a sentence that's already been completed.
Is I the one off paper?
Not at the time it happened.
Not
no.
at the time.
And
okay.
and that's – it's true that this – these two cases do not raise that, at least at the time that the circuit courts dealt with it.
That's right.
There's certainly a problem with Mr. Gilbert now, who is now off paper.
But it all would have to relate back.
The state would not be able to refile on Mr. Gilbert. It could on Mr. Hunt because he's still on paper, and so they could file a discharge for him, but not for Mr. Gilbert.
You may not be able to answer this, but the Chapter 980 has been the law for quite a while now. Have these fact situations come up before?
I haven't seen it. This is the first time I've seen it. But, of course, I only see the appellate ones. So my people that do trials tell me that they have on occasions dismissed cases like that. I think the problem, though, even as a prudential matter, the state chooses to dismiss, is the situation where we can't refile. And for that reason, it seems to me it would be against the legislative intent to find that the legislature intended in all cases that the petition be dismissed when somebody is convicted of a new crime or revoked from parole or supervision.
How do you interpret 980.076M?
Well, I think it is correct that the way it has been interpreted to this point, at least, it applies when the judgment is the criminal judgment is entered second. However, the language actually says, the language actually says, if the person committed under S-980-06 is incarcerated, I think it's possible to say that means the commitment can post-date the incarceration. I did try to find some cases interpreting that it's not strictly in the past tense, but I think most the few cases that I could find that even approached interpreting that is incarcerated type language tended to view it as past tense. So I did not pursue that. I did think about it. I don't think that would necessarily prohibit this court from interpreting it that way, but I guess I would have to concede it's a bit strained.
So how do you interpret it reasonably?
I think the way it has been viewed both by prosecutorial and courts to date is that the criminal conviction is entered after the judgment of commitment, and that what happens is that when the person is convicted and under the Krzyzewski model, the criminal sentence takes effect immediately, assuming that that's what the circuit court decides, that what happens is that the DHS just suspends the period of annual examination. There was a comment I recall, I don't remember which counsel made it, about the schedule in 07 sub 1 not being able to be complied with or interpreted in this kind of situation, and I don't agree with that. It's obviously beyond 6 months of the initial commitment, so there's no 6 months, but the only other thing that the scheduling says is at least once each 12, not more than 12 months, at least each 12 months. So they could do it immediately, which probably would be the prudent thing to do, but so long as there was an examination within 12 months of return to DHS, I think the schedule is, in fact, complied with and could be complied with whether or not it applies to before or after criminal conviction.
Why do you think the or because his or her parole was revoked is put where it is in the statute?
Well, I...
What makes you think that has to be revocation for a new charge? It doesn't say that.
Well, what it says is if the person is incarcerated in the county for a new criminal charge or conviction or because his parole was revoked.
It doesn't now, say parole revoked for a new criminal charge or conviction. That precedes the previous two ways somebody goes to jail. It says or, and it's separate, or because their parole is revoked.
Well, I think what that means is if the person, setting aside the problem that it doesn't say extended supervision, I think what that means is if the person is returned to DOC custody under either of these two methods, which is a new conviction or a revocation. Now, technically, when a person is revoked, they're serving a commitment, a criminal conviction. It's the criminal conviction that was already entered.
Right.
The order
that doesn't necessarily
mean just administrative
revocation on a new charge subsequent to commitment.
Right. It could be both, actually.
So it's not
uncommon to have both a revocation and a new charge.
Okay. I just wondered when you
I think that the legislature here was just wording the language so that they covered if, as many times happens in prosecutors' offices, they say, well, they're going back for a long revocation. We're not going to refile a criminal charge and go through a trial. They wanted to make sure that the suspension took effect for the revocation.
Could be revoked not for a new criminal charge, but because conditions have not been met.
That's the point.
I know.
Well, but if there's, I guess I don't understand how that could happen. Either the person is charged with a new crime or they're revoked, right? Otherwise, they remain in the custody of DHS.
You have the word conviction in that statute. It could be conviction, which
well,
can be...
The word conviction's not, well...
Of course it's in the statute, in 6M.
It says if the person is incarcerated...
Right, under
for a new criminal charge or conviction.
Right. And you said, if I heard you correct, that conviction could mean a new conviction for a new crime, or it could mean the old conviction.
Well, what I said was a revocation puts the person back in the custody of DOC under
right.
a prior,
right.
I won't use old, a prior conviction.
That's right. So that the question is what is the meaning or what is the advantage of putting in or because his or her parole was revoked, isn't it?
I guess I don't see either the person is charged with a new
right.
crime
mm-hmm.
and convicted of it,
right,
or they're revoked,
right,
or both. So if the person doesn't remain in DHS custody, it's either the result of a revocation, mm-hmm, or a new crime. I don't see any other alternative.
But the requirement isn't that the revocation be for a new post-commitment crime.
I don't read the statute that way.
That's
I read
what
the
my
statute
point is.
That either a new crime or a
the
revocation
crime
of a prior crime.
Right. If you read
I
it,
I don't see any other. I guess I'm just missing the point. I don't see any other option.
But I thought you were saying that 6M seemed to apply only to post-commitment new crimes. And if it did, they wouldn't need that or parole revoked language in there.
Let me try to say it again.
You don't need to say it for me. Okay.
Okay.
Go with someone else's question.
I guess the other thing that I would note is both Hunt and Gilbert put considerable weight on the language of 06, but 06 never applied to either one of them until they were actually found to be sexually violent persons. So at the time Mr. Hunt filed his motion to dismiss, he wasn't subject to 06. And Mr. Gilbert was, but only because he didn't file a motion to dismiss. He dealt with it in a post-conviction proceeding or post-commitment proceeding. Now, I'm not saying he was required to file the motion and to not waive the issue, but nevertheless, it is significant, it seems to me, that they rely on language that doesn't apply at the time that Mr. Hunt filed his motion. And yet, they want to get around 07 because they say that doesn't apply until the person's actually committed. It seems that's inconsistent. Just like when you say, well, the two commitment orders can exist at the same time if the commitment's entered first, but the conviction's entered second, but the reverse can't exist, and gee, there's no language that you could hook on to reach that conclusion.
To preserve the constitutionality of this statute, prior cases have indicated that protection of the public and treatment is important. Treatment is a essential ingredient to maintain the constitutionality of this statutory scheme. I listen to the argument, and there's lots of discussion about this word and that word, and that's what we do, because words are important. But when I step back and I say, Mr. Gilbert was, 2.5 years, according to the testimony, without any treatment whatsoever, because it wasn't afforded by WAPON, without any opportunity for the annual evaluation, without any thing that meets treatment under 980, so that's the picture that's painted because those are the facts we have before us. Doesn't that cause a problem?
Well, I have two observations. To the extent that's the case, it's because of his own behavior.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's true with all of us, you know.
Well, but
but I mean,
but
I'm talking about preserving
it?
The Constitution. I mean, we're all accountable for our own behavior.
But the other thing
but
is,
I'm talking about preserving, as a court,
right,
preserving
but,
the constitutionality of the statutory scheme.
I don't think that the Constitution requires treatment because Hendricks says you can commit somebody who's not amenable to treatment. I think DHS has to offer treatment. But there are all kinds of folks at Sand Ridge who refuse treatment. They're not receiving treatment. They have the opportunity.
There was no opportunity, apparently, according
to the
testimony.
Well, but it wasn't DHS's fault. It was DOC's fault.
I don't care whose fault it was. The question is, did he get any treatment? I mean, either this is a punitive statute, 980, or it isn't. And one of the indicia of being non-punitive is treatment.
But we know that you don't judge the statute's constitutionality, at least vis-a-vis punishment, a finding of punishment under either ex post facto or double jeopardy, based on the way the administrative agency enforces the statute. You have to look at the language of the statute, and the language clearly provides for treatment. So to the extent there's a problem, there's a as-applied problem for DOC, not DHS. And that, by the way,
who represent DOC?
Where am I getting that?
No, I want to know who you represent.
Well, from your cases, I get that.
I want to know, do you represent DOC or DHSS?
I'm sorry?
Who do you represent?
I represent DHS. Well, I represent the state, which is neither one.
Or is both.
That's not in these
problem.
Cases. As we well know, the state and DHS part company frequently on these cases.
I know. That's why I asked you who you represent in this case.
I think the problem, though, is that Mr. Gilbert was suffering the consequences of his lawfully imposed criminal conviction. And why would that make 980 unconstitutional?
Well, why? Go ahead.
In the best of all worlds, would you continue to permit the circuit court to decide which takes priority, the conviction or the treatment, such that when the conviction is for something extremely significant and there would be, say, a 6 or 7 year period of incarceration, that might come first? And isn't there some point at time, if we do that you do have to have a new hearing on the mental status of the earlier committee?
I think that's
kind of
two questions
I gave you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let me tackle the first one first.
Okay.
The problem, I think, is that there's no language comparable to 973-19, whatever the language was at issue in Shulshevsky. There's no authority for the circuit court
to
stay the proceeding. Now, if this court were to find that the court had inherent authority to do it, that might well solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, we don't have either a statutory ability to stay or a finding that the circuit court has inherent authority or language, an opinion from this court or the Court of Appeals that the circuit court has the inherent authority to do it. And so I think for that reason, as both Mr. Hunt and Mr. Gilbert point out, there isn't at this point in time any authority to do that.
Well,
now, the second part of the question.
Well, my concern kind of stuck them both together. Just say that there was a crime that occurred during parole, and it was extremely significant, and there was a sentence imposed with incarceration, part of that sentence being 7 or 8 years, and that occurred during the course of the commitment proceedings. I know you have concerns about giving someone who commits violent conduct a pass from being accountable under DOC's rules, and opposing counsel have concerns about having the commitment and then staying the treatment part that goes along with the commitment. And it just seems that at some point in time they have to be right. In other words, if you had the commitment proceedings and the conviction of a serious crime and the man were sentenced or woman were sentenced to a significant period of time for incarceration, no matter what we might decide or try to construct with regard to discretion, isn't there at some point in time going to be a problem without having a current hearing on what the condition of the person is that you're alleging is sexually violent?
Well, constitutionally, there's no requirement for a hearing. There's a requirement for a determination.
Okay, well, whatever.
But
and process. I mean, that's the whole thing.
And I think that's resolved by when the person is returned to DHS custody, if ever,
yeah.
DHS makes that determination. And under the statute, then the person can proceed for discharge or supervised release if they want to. Actually, they can probably do that while they're even incarcerated. There's no limitation on the statute.
How do you anticipate that occurring? So someone's incarcerated for 7 years.
they are then now returned to DHSS.
They do a periodic reexamination the way they do annually.
Right, but at that particular point in time, he doesn't have a right to a jury trial on the finding of his...
No, he's already had the jury trial. We're assuming that he's been committed and found to be
sexually violent. No, I got that.
Violent.
I got that. But
well,
it is
and that's why, to me, it's important to say what the Constitution requires is not that you have a jury finding that the person has a mental disorder now, if now is when they go back to prison.
Yeah.
It's at the time that the court enters the commitment.
Right.
And they had a jury trial immediately before that, and there is now an adjudication that the person is a sexually violent person. So now the only thing the Constitution requires is periodic determination that both mental disorder and dangerousness still exist.
Okay, so you just send them back, and when you send them back, they happen to have another hearing or a determination, maybe on
some determination. Mm-hmm. One could say, can say either a hearing or just an administrative determination. Experience in this field has taught us that it's almost always at least a hearing before a judge. Okay. So we're going to have a determination when the person returns to DHS. It won't be a jury trial. Well, it might if the judge finds there's sufficient change, and so it might be a jury trial.
Right, then you
but
can go to the
second step.
But it
wouldn't necessarily be.
Procedurally in that instance, how would you envision it working in, as far as the committing court? Would you envision the court grant ordering a stay of the commitment or ordering a commitment of the type of judgment without the physical?
I think, and this is the way it would work or does work, if the criminal conviction is entered second, the commitment order is the same as any commitment order. And then we have a criminal judgment, which is the same as any criminal judgment. The question is, what happens to the person?
And what would happen if DHS ever disagreed with the DOC placement?
Well, actually, that has happened, and to date, everyone has believed that the Krzyzewski two cases resolved that to say that the criminal conviction takes precedence. So if the person has both a conviction and a commitment of any kind, they go to DOC. But that's...
Which doesn't really run afoul of any of the statutory language in the 980, because there's nothing that says that DHS has to.
Unless you read it as immediate custody, that's right.
Unless it's immediate.
And the reason it seems to me you can't read it as immediate custody is if you do, then what happens to 6M? That's obviously not immediate custody.
Well, under 6M, if I understand it.
I'm sorry, 076M.
Yeah, under 6M.
I misspoke.
He's committed to under 980. And if he's then incarcerated, then various reporting requirements don't come into play. Where does he go under 6M? Is he in county jail or state correctional institution or federal correctional institution for the new charge? But under 980.06, it says the court determines he's the subject of a petition. Court orders him committed. And he's committed for care, custody, and care, control, care, and treatment. That's their point under 06, which you say he never comes under 06.
Well, both these gentlemen were subject to an 06 order. But that was because the proceeding proceeded to judgment.
Mm-hmm.
At the time Mr. Hunt filed his motion, it hadn't proceeded to judgment yet. So 06 kicks in when the jury comes back and says, we find this person to be a sexually violent person. Well, at that point, then, it seems to me, the person is someone who has been, who is now, or at least arguably, is incarcerated and is subject to a commitment under 980.06. If in the case where the conviction comes second, I don't think there's any question that that's a person who is subject to an 06 order and that 07, save for 076M, 07 sub 1 would require a reevaluation of that person while they were in prison at least once every 12 months. And in fact, that's what was the genesis of 06M, of 076M is. DHS didn't want to have to do that.
So what kind of opinion should this court? What kind of opinion should this court write?
Sorry?
What kind of opinion do you want this court to write?
Well, my first choice would be that a subsequent revocation or new sentence does not require dismissal of a petition, and that it can proceed to judgment, and that I don't have strong feelings about which one should take precedence in 980. I just think that under current law, it's the criminal conviction, and I think the danger of having it the other way is that it doesn't, it denigrates the criminal side of things, but without the stay provision, that's, you got to denigrate one or the other. So, you know.
What are we doing?
It would not disturb me if the person remained at DHS. It would probably disturb DOC people, and it would probably disturb a lot of DAs. But personally, if the person is committed and has the conviction, that's, to me, that's good.
Who makes the choice if he stays with DHSS or goes to DOC?
I'm sorry?
Who makes the choice whether he stays in you say you don't care. Who makes the choice?
Under the ideal situation, I would think I would like the circuit court to make it the way it works in NGI, but again, the problem is finding the authority for that.
So what's the Solomon-like result?
I'm sorry.
What's the Solomon-like result in this case? We got two entities who want charge of him.
I'm sorry.
Okay. We have two entities who want charge of him. One is the Department of Corrections and one is DHSS.
Right.
What does the court do?
Well, I think under current law, DOC has the right to him. And DHS at this point agrees with that. So there's no law, there's no disagreement amongst the agencies right now.
Okay. And they have the right to him under what statutory provision?
Unless the court wants to find that the circuit court has inherent authority, yeah.
Well, let's not go overboard here.
Yeah, right.
All right, we got enough problems without inherent authority.
If we worked it the way NGI works, then, yeah, what we would need would be a statutory provision in 980 giving the circuit court the authority to stay either as it saw fit, either stay the petition and wait until after the conviction ran to have the trial, or to go ahead with the trial and stay the physical confinement, either way.
Okay.
Either way would satisfy the problems we have in these cases.
Isn't that what Mr. Hunt wants?
That's what Mr. Hunt, well, that's not what he wants, it's willing to take it.
That's what I'm saying, and I started out asking you that question. That's what the state's willing to give.
Counsel, when a trial court judge sentences someone, do you think they have authority on a criminal case to sentence them to the custody of DHS?
No.
So when
only
you are revoking someone or imposing a sentence of extended supervision or dealing with a sentence on a new crime, where, without it being a sea change in the law, where would we find the authority for a trial court judge to say, oh, well, we're just going to impose a sentence that DHS can deal with? It doesn't exist.
You couldn't. But the way, if we're talking about the criminal sentence being entered second.
Well, there are two separate cases.
Right.
There's a commitment that is a civil commitment. There is a criminal case that a judge is imposing sentence on. And I thought I heard you say, boy, I really don't care. It'd be okay if the judge said in the criminal case you can go to DHS.
Well, but the judge has in 973, I think it's 19, but I'm not positive of the subsection. It's the language that was at issue in Krzyzewski. In a criminal case, the judge has authority to stay for legal cause, and what 15, thank you. And what Krzyzewski says is an NGI commitment constitutes sufficient legal cause for the circuit court to stay the criminal proceeding, the criminal sentence. If the criminal sentence is stayed, then the commitment now continues. The criminal sentence is stayed until the person is discharged. In the NGI situation, that's a date certain.
Well, then the person isn't being revoked or placed in prison on extended supervision.
We're not talking about 980's language. We're talking about 973 language.
Right.
And 973 language says a court can stay the execution of the sentence for legal cause.
If they stay the execution, they don't go to DOC, though.
Well, what it does is it prevents DOC from taking a physical custody under the authority of the order. It stays the execution of the order. So the order is not – that's why, to me, this whole case is about execution, not about the order itself. What the stay does is it prevents DOC or the sheriff from executing the criminal conviction. And in that case, the commitment proceeds until discharge. At that point, the sheriff executes the criminal conviction and the person goes to DOC.
Does the trial court have the power to stay a Chapter 980 petition?
I'm sorry.
Does the trial court have the power to stay a Chapter 980 petition? No. Is that your answer?
Not unless you either interpret the continuance language to encompass a stay, which, is, like I said, that's an awful long continuance, or you find some authority outside the language of the statute. There's no statutory language upon which the circuit court could base such a stay.
Counsel,
Justice Bradley.
You argue with the Krzyzewski case in part because you argued the Krzyzewski case, but after that, based on the same reasoning, and that was a 973 case.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. It's actually White.
White is the one after that that implemented the same rationale, but in the context of a 980.
That's correct.
So
the Court of Appeals has held that in White.
Yeah, that's
you're absolutely right.
Krzyzewski
is just an NGI case, and it's the reasoning that we're relying on.
That's right. And in a 980, White said that the circuit court has the authority to stay his sentence
the
until
criminal
just
sentence
criminal
in favor
sentence
of
until
of
discharge or release from the 980.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Good. Let's end on that.
Not quite. Mr. Weinstein, did you want to say anything else?
No. Unless the court
you
has
can
some,
repeat your last statement.
If we have some other questions, I'm happy to sit down.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Scheiber?
There are just two brief points I'd like to make on rebuttal. The first goes back to a question Justice Gableman posed, and that's about what the word commitment actually means. The state's arguing that the word commitment does not mean actual placement in DHS custody for initial petition and commitment order. I'd like to direct the court's attention to 980.065, which says directly that upon commitment, the department shall place a person committed under 980.06 at a facility that's operated by DHS. So there is language that suggests that that states directly that when a commitment order is entered under 980.06, the person shall be placed in a facility that's operated by DHS. And that didn't happen here. This, as the state pointed out, the problem is nowhere in Chapter 980 does the legislature provide the circuit court the authority to stay a 980 commitment. The state noted that the Sizlecki, and I'm saying the name of that case differently, and White cases suggest that it's the criminal sentence that takes precedent. But in actuality, when we look at those cases, it's just the opposite. Both of those cases tell us that under 973.15 sub 8A, the circuit court has the authority to stay the criminal sentence. Notably, nowhere in Chapter 980 does the circuit court or does the legislature provide the circuit court to stay the execution of a 980 commitment. And the second point that I'd like to make goes back to Justice Bradley's question about treatment. The state noted that while a person who's subject to a 980 commitment can't be forced into treatment, treatment has to be offered. And that's a crucial point. The problem here is that for Mr. Gilbert, treatment was wholly unavailable for 2.5 years. It was not offered to him. And in his case, it's 2.5 years. In the next case, it could be 10 years. Within this, the state said, well, okay, even if he doesn't have treatment, when he finally finishes his sentence of imprisonment and finally is civilly committed and actually placed in DHS custody, he'll have the opportunity to petition for a discharge. And I'd just like to note the significant differences between the initial commitment proceedings and a petition for discharge. When the state files a petition and proceeds to trial and to civilly commit somebody, at that point, the burden is on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that person is a sexually violent person. When we are talking a petition for discharge, the initial burden rests on the petitioner to prove and allege facts by clear and convincing evidence that he is no longer a proper subject for commitment. A core problem here is that when we look at the criteria for a petition for discharge, we look at whether or not, the state and DHS looks at whether or not the person has made significant progress in treatment. Significant progress in treatment is defined in 980.01 sub 8, and it means that the person has done all of the following, including meaningfully participated in the treatment program specifically designed to reduce his risk to reoffend, offered at a facility described in 980.065, and again, that's institutional care in DHS custody. So when Mr. Gilbert or potential persons in the future arrive at DHS, they will be entirely unable to meet that standard because they haven't had the opportunity for treatment.
Counsel, would you kindly restate the statutory provision that you started your rebuttal with in regard to the immediate placement upon commitment?
Sure. In 980.065, it's 1M, the department shall place a person committed under 980.06 at the secure mental health facility established, and then it continues.
I heard you to say upon commitment. Mm-hmm. I believe that's what you said earlier. I don't believe that's what the statute says.
Oh, I apologize then. That was my misreading of the statute. But the point there is that it talks about actual placement in DHS custody beyond the word commitment. And it is for these reasons that Mr. Gilbert respectfully requests that this court vacate the 980 order against him. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. I want to thank all the counsel today for their excellent argument on using to some, maybe to all, set of statutes that have to be interpreted, and perhaps there's a hole in them, and the question is how to interpret them and fill the hole, if any. So that ends our argument in this case of yet another Chapter 980, 10 AP 594, State versus Gilbert, 10 AP 1155, State versus Hunt. The court is in recess until our next oral argument tomorrow, and the court, pardon me?
Thursday.
Okay. Tomorrow we're doing something else. And we are in, we shall meet in closed conference at 3:45.